Hello, and welcome to this bonus episode of The Overturn, where we explain what it really took for this series to come to life and dig deeper into a system that keeps innocent people behind bars. My name's Barney Duke, I'm the producer and host of this series, and today I'm joined by two very special guests from the Future Justice Project, who have dedicated years and years to helping victims of wrongful conviction and reforming our justice system. John Robbins is a lecturer in criminology at Brighton University and a journalist by background who spent 30 years reporting on justice issues in general and miscarriages of justice in particular. He is the founder and editor of the online magazine The Justice Gap. Glyn Maddox is a lawyer with specialist expertise in miscarriage of justice cases. In 2020, he was appointed as an honorary KC in recognition of his work fighting wrongful convictions. He has had a number of notable successes in the courts, working almost entirely in a pro bono or unpaid capacity. Together, Glyn and John run a new legal charity called the Future Justice Project, which is aimed at reforming the criminal justice system so as to prevent wrongful convictions and to properly recognise those innocent prisoners who've been locked up often for years, maybe even decades, for crimes they didn't commit. Glyn, when you look at the justice system today, just how bad are things?
Well, I think it's probably in the worst state it's ever been, and it's getting worse. Week by week, month by month, we've got a huge backlog of cases waiting to go to trial. Some trials are now being listed for 2029 or 2030. We've got a huge number of people in prison, quite a considerable number of whom probably didn't do it, maybe 5 to 10%. Is according to most estimates, although no one's quite sure exactly how many people are inside prison for things they didn't do. There's no accurate figures on that. But the CCRC, which is the body set up to look at alleged miscarriages of justice, gets about 1,500 to 1,600 applicants every year and has, over the last 30 years, looked at over 30,000 cases. The criminal justice system has been drained of money over the last 15 years, more than any other department of government. Court buildings are being closed. They've got leaking roofs. Judges are retiring. There's no legal aid. I mean, it's difficult to imagine or describe how it could be much worse than it is at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the Criminal Cases Review Commission there. Let's talk a bit about that. John, can you tell us a bit about the organisation, how it came to be?
Yeah, so the organisation was set up in 1997 after years of kind of campaigning and a series of terrible miscarriages of justice, which happened from the 1970s and the 1980s, most notably the kind of the Irish cases like the Birmingham 6 and the Guildford 4. But there were other miscarriage cases as well, kind of non-terrorism cases, such as the Cardiff 3 and Stefan Kishko. And that kind of there was such anger, kind of visceral. It's hard to explain to people now what it was like then. There was a kind of strong visceral sense of anger at the failure of the justice system to get to grips with these kind of difficult cases. And that anger led to the creation of kind of demand for change. And ultimately, there was a Royal Commission, and the Royal Commission was announced on the day the Birmingham Six left the Old Bailey as free people after 16 years in prison. And that ultimately led to this organisation, the Criminal Cases Review Commission, which was at that point in time was a pioneering organisation. There was nothing like it in the world, and we were promised a miscarriage of justice kind of watchdog. And now, you know, if you are wrongly convicted and you're kind of in the prison cell rotting away, you need to apply to the CCRC. And over the years, it's been massively undermined by successive governments not sufficiently funding it, but also undermined by the courts. And ultimately, it's become challenged kind of internally, culturally. It's kind of collapsed, really, and it's lost its sense of purpose. And I think kind of lazily journalists, and including myself, kind of refer to it as this kind of watchdog body, but actually it doesn't have that proactive energy that you would expect of a watchdog body. So it's a controversial, problematic organisation. And interestingly, with this podcast, it's a feature, and I think in all of those stories, ultimately, pretty much most of these cases are stuck within the justice system, and they're stuck in two parts of the justice system. One is within the Criminal Cases Review Commission, and then the second layer behind the CCRC is a problematic kind of state of the Court of Appeal. And I think what's frustrating from our point of view is that often the criticism of the CCRC, it stops at the CCRC, and we don't look more deeply into the problems within the justice system and the problems that we faced or kind of previous generations of journalist campaigners faced in the bad old days of the 1970s and 80s, the problems with miscarriages of justice kind of almost get hidden. I think, you know, I would say we are in many ways no better off than we were back in the 1970s. Things are as bad as they ever were. But actually, the CCRC in some ways disguises a clear understanding of what's going on with the criminal justice system.
It's really interesting that there seems to be this huge disparity in, you know, people believing that our justice system is this, as you say, kind of pioneering and something to really be proud of within this country. And it seems to be actually a big misconception. And you write a lot in your work about the difference between law and justice, John. Could you explain a little bit what that difference is?
Yeah, I mean, I use the phrase the justice gap. And it's kind of when you understand these stories that are miscarriages of justice that that phrase really kind of has full effect, because they don't really ever get kind of true justice in the sense, even if you kind of fight all the odds, you get your conviction overturned. The justice system deals with the law. It doesn't deal with justice in the sense that most people would expect it to. And it's a very legalistic process. And I think these cases also kind of highlight the kind of institutional defensiveness within the system. And I suppose it's the reality of the law and the fight for justice, which is what we're trying to capture here, and the gulf between the two.
And another thing that we touch on quite a lot in the series is this idea that everyone is equal under the eyes of the law. Glyn, could you maybe talk a bit about access to justice?
Access to justice. I mean, in theory, yes. It's an even playing field between the prosecution and the defence. I say in theory only. The reality is far from that, sadly. The prosecution, police, you know, who are doing the investigation, have a huge amount of resources to throw at cases and throw at the investigation. The defence have virtually nothing in comparison. I mean, it's usually one solicitor and maybe a barrister and a small amount of legal aid, which is, you know, penny pinched most of the time. And it's extremely difficult to ever think that there's an equality of arms or that there is an even playing field. Despite what the theory says, it doesn't work out like that. I mean, lots of solicitors do not do because they haven't got the resources. They just haven't got the bandwidth to be able to spend the time reading all the statements, looking at all the unused material, if there is any, going through all the prosecution evidence to actually put the defence that needs to be put. So it's very unequal, which is why we've got a conviction rate of, you know, 80-something percent most years. It's very much easier for the Crown, for the prosecution, for the police, who, you know, may have 50 people working on a case, to get what they need to get it across the line in front of a jury. And that isn't fair. If it was an equal playing field, the defence would have unlimited resources to be able to go through everything and look at the evidence in a much more objective way and impartial way. But they can't. Justice is in theory only in this country, sadly.
So if someone was to find themselves wrongfully convicted, for someone who doesn't know, how do you go about appealing that conviction?
Well, simply, you have to find someone who's going to prepare to help you. I mean, there's an anecdotal story that I heard, which is probably true, where a person was convicted. He said wrongly. He went to his solicitor at the end of the trial and he said, you know, what do I do now? What happens? You know, I want to fight this. And the solicitor said to him, looked at him and said, well, I'm out of this now because obviously legal aid is finished. I've done my job. But I understand there's some sort of organization, I'm not quite sure what it's called, in Birmingham that might be able to help you. But when you get to prison, they might give you an application form. Now, that's it, in a way. You have to think about making an application to the CCRC. And the CCRC, the application form is quite simple, but it will ask you about what fresh evidence you've got. What evidence have you got to prove that you didn't do what you've been convicted of? That's the hard bit. You can't use anything that's already been used at the trial. It would have to be something new, something fresh, and something that's going to make a material difference. So a new witness coming along who can say that you were with them at the time or whatever is about, you know, it's the sort of thing, or in the case of, you know, some famous examples like Andy Malkinson, some DNA, but it took him 17 years, I think, to persuade the CCRC and then the Court of Appeal that that evidence was sufficient to justify his conviction being quashed. It is the most Herculean task imaginable. And whenever I have new clients, I say to them, basically, you know, this is the most difficult thing you'll have ever tried to achieve. This is climbing Everest, effectively, without any equipment. It is massive, and most people fail. And yeah, most solicitors fail.
Yeah, I mean, if I could just kind of flesh out the kind of the impossibility, really, of the odds facing someone. So if you are that person wrongly convicted in prison, you know, your one route, really, yeah, is to make this application, as Glyn's just described, to the CCRC, and Glyn was saying you need fresh evidence or you need new arguments, and the real possibility test is this kind of hurdle. So the CCRC organization, as I described before, this organization that's supposed to kind of come to save the innocent wrongly convicted, has to be convinced there's a real possibility in the Court of Appeal overturning your conviction. So this kind of watchdog body effectively has to second guess what the courts would accept. And this has a kind of a it's been described as a statutory stranglehold on the CCRC. So it kind of, the CCRC is a kind of a creation of the courts, effectively. So it's not as it would appear to be. And to kind of put the statistical kind of to flesh it out in terms of numbers, every year, 1,500 people, you know, we have the biggest prison population in Western Europe, 87,000 people in prison every year, 1,500 people, mainly prisoners, they write to Birmingham saying that they are innocent. And of those number, between 1 and 2%, typically in the last kind of 5-10 years, have made it back to the Court of Appeal. And then the Court of Appeal has only overturned, you know, 7 out of 10. And then if you kind of successfully surmount all those hurdles, there is almost no chance, you haven't got a hope in hell of getting compensation. So when we talk about the difference between law and justice, and, you know, kind of miscarriage of justice expressing that gulf, that's it in a nutshell, really. That's the impossibility of it.
Mm. Can you talk a bit about compensation and why it's so unlikely?
One of my clients, who I acted for many years ago, I think his conviction was quashed in 2005. And I said to him fairly recently, I said, Paul, you were lucky. And he sort of swore at me, to be quite honest. And he said, what do you mean I was lucky? I was in prison for 25 years for something I didn't do. I said, yeah, Paul, but you managed to get, we managed to get your conviction referred by the CCRC, which is incredibly difficult, and you were lucky to do that. And then when you had your conviction quashed, you managed to get, you know, over £1 million in compensation. Had this happened to you recently, you wouldn't have got either of those, probably, in my view. The CCRC has got more restrictive. And since 2014, in your situation, you wouldn't have got compensation at all. So you'd have been, you'd have probably been released eventually, but you would have not had your conviction quashed. So you'd still be on life license for the rest of your life, and you wouldn't have got a penny from the state.
And we should say something more about compensation, because the you know, the people that you're talking to are people who are kind of, they're kind of stuck within the system, and they are not driven by money. But as someone of the victims of miscarriage of justice recently said, in fact, it was Patrick Maguire of the Maguire Seven, who was imprisoned at the age of 15 as part of those Irish cases I mentioned before. He said that the government of, it's not about money as far as the victims of miscarriage of justice are concerned, but the government have made it about money, because as Glyn was saying, in 2014, they changed the law. And of all the kind of draconian measures that have been introduced to kind of undermine the integrity of our justice system, this is perhaps the worst thing that happened, but very few people know about it. Introduced by Chris Grayling, probably the worst justice minister in history. And he introduced this kind of a limit on the statutory test, whereby if you have your conviction overturned, you will only get compensation if you can prove your innocence beyond reasonable doubt. And that is a perversion of our justice system. The whole point of our justice system is predicated on the idea that the prosecution has to prove the guilt of the defendants beyond a reasonable doubt. That's arbitrarily been applied to people who have been completely damaged and ruined by the state. They've been let down by the police. Sometimes there's been malice and misconduct in these cases that we look at. They've been failed massively by the courts. They never get an apology. The Court of Appeal almost never apologises for what happens to these people. And these lives have been ruined. You know, the damage to lose your liberty, to be locked away in prison, it is irreversible and profound. You know, there's plenty of psychological evidence to that. But also the damage spreads ripples. And that's, you know, you're often talking to family members. And actually, they live it for years, this horrible reality. None of that is recognized. When people have their convictions overturned, you know, this has happened. I've interviewed people who have just left prison with a bin liner with their contents, with £46 in their pocket, which is what prisoners get when they leave prison. And they would have been homeless. One person that I interviewed a few years ago, and he would have spent the first night sleeping on the streets had it not been for a BBC journalist who said, actually, if you do an interview, I'll pay for your B&B tonight. And that's how he ended up, first night of freedom, in a B&B. And then he slept on the floor of his MP's office for the next few months. I mean, that's how we treat the wrongly convicted. Yeah. It is a scandal.
When my client Oliver Campbell has had his conviction quashed back in September 2024, most of the questions from the media was, how much is he going to get? And I said to all of them, he's not going to get anything. It's absolutely impossible. And they did not know that. So that change that happened, that draconian change that happened in 2014, was never publicised appropriate. And the media still doesn't get it, which is, I think, you know, a dereliction of duty. Because had they got it properly and campaigned, I think the government would have been put under pressure, like it was after Andy Malkinson's conviction was quashed. And the media campaigned, the Today programme, were keen on it, for Borden Lodge to be abolished. And over one weekend, the Justice Secretary, Alex Chalk, said, we're not going to deduct any Borden Lodge from anyone's compensation from now onwards. But the bigger question and the bigger issue was the fact that most people aren't going to get compensation anyway. So it was an empty promise from the government, which no one really seemed to pick up on, which seems to me to be bizarre and again, a dereliction of duty. So, you know, the whole issue of compensation is a disgrace and something that we cannot possibly be proud of in this country. Even most American states, when someone is exonerated, pay compensation, and all European democracies pay compensation appropriately when someone is found to be not guilty of something they've been in prison for. Mm-hmm. Why do we think that we shouldn't be paying compensation? The postmasters are all being compensated. In fact, there was a big hoo-ha about that, which is right. They should be compensated and appropriately so. You know, it's going to run into millions. People like Oliver Campbell don't get compensation. Why is that? How can that be justified? And a Labour government, you know, with Keir Starmer, who's actually written about miscarriages of justice, probably the first prime minister in history to have got experience of dealing with miscarriages of justice, hasn't said a word. You know, I think he said we're looking into it, I think, in the House of Commons a few months ago, but that's it. Looking into it when? And the big worry that we've got is that if the Law Commission, for instance, recommends compensation be reintroduced, will it be backdated to those people like Oliver Campbell whose convictions were quashed, you know, during this period between abolishing compensation and maybe reintroducing it? Terribly unfair.
So tell me how the Future Justice Project is working to address some of these structural issues.
We set up the Future Justice Project 3 years ago, and it's set up by myself, Glyn and Barry Shearman, MP. And we came together when I wrote a book about the Tony Stock case. Glyn obviously was Tony's lawyer for several decades, and Barry campaigned as an MP on behalf of Tony. And that kind of led to us kind of pushing for change. And ultimately, we were very concerned, actually, because the number of referrals at the CCRC just crashed in 2016 to just 12. So it was below 1%, which is the first time ever. And we were saying, actually, this kind of speaks to structural problems within the CCRC. And in about 2017, 2018, Barry Shearman set up the All-Party Parliamentary Group, which kind of very much driven by Barry and Glyn, and I suppose our experience with the Tony Stock case as well. Future Justice Project kind of took over the secretariat for the parliamentary group. And we've managed to build on very minimal parliamentary interest, actually. It's kind of shocking to us that...
It's getting better.
Yeah, when we joined the APP APPG, we had just, I think, seven MPs. Kim Johnson, over the years, we built that up to more than 30 MPs. So we've seen kind of a bit of an explosion of interest, parliamentary interest, in the issue. And we feel kind of actually that the parliamentary group has been influential, and we've been working in areas to do with joint enterprise. So we set up the Westminster Commission on Joint Enterprise. As you'll know from the Alex Henry, kind of joint enterprise is a source of huge miscarriages of justice in our country, and is a deeply racist kind of legal principle that needs to be kind of tackled. So we set up the Westminster Commission on Joint Enterprise. We set up a Westminster Commission on Forensic Science because we're very concerned about the diminishing quality of forensic science and how that contributes to miscarriages of justice. We're campaigning around legal aid, and we're campaigning around the lack of media interest in miscarriages of justice. So we're hoping to launch a Westminster Commission on the media. So in a small number of years, I think we kind of highlighted some really kind of serious big issues.
And the media can be really powerful in advocating for these cases. John, why do you think there's been such disinterest in the past few years?
I mean, it is sadly true that there has been a retreat of press interest in miscarriage of justice cases. And I think that there are lots of complicated reasons for that, to do with the economics of newspapers and broadcasting media, and the fact that there isn't the budgets to do these kind of difficult investigation of cases. And I think, you know, I just about remember Rough Justice and Trial and Error. There was a kind of sense that there was a public service ethos behind kind of the big broadcasters and newspapers to actually look at these cases. And that has, I'm afraid to say, gone completely, I would say now. Another problem is because of the problems with the appeal system and the fact that it has become an impossible battle. And we have this problematic organisation, the Criminal Cases Review Commission. Cases get stuck in the system, and that's very unsatisfactory for an editor to commission a fantastic article about such and such a case if it's never going to go anywhere. You know, there's no incentive. I think journalists individually, you know, recognise that these are important stories. But what we're definitely not seeing much of at all is journalists championing the victims of miscarriage of justice when they need their help, which is pre-Court of Appeal, when the convictions aren't overturned. We see a lot of articles after convictions being overturned. Yeah. That's just no good whatsoever.
It's too late,
so I think we're interested in thinking about how you can reinvigorate press interest, ways of doing it.
You've probably had this, John, but I've had lots of inquiries. And then you tell them a story and they say, well, is there a happy ending with this? And I say, well, no, maybe not. And they say, oh, I don't think we'll sell it. Our editor will buy that then. They want outcomes.
Well, they want a clean story as well.
Yeah, clean story where there's a beginning, a middle, and a good end. Any unsatisfactory end, wow, no interest then at all. With the Rough Justice and the Trial and Error, they wanted to make the story in a way. They actually rolled their sleeves up and they put, you know.
There have been cases recently which have been quite high profile. And the notable one is Andrew Malkinson. And there's been great work by Emily Dugan on The Guardian on that case. And there have been other cases. Lucy Letby is really, really interesting because that's the first case I can think of where the media has kind of really come together. I know most people probably still think that she is guilty, but there have been many journalists from Private Eye, brilliant work done by Private Eye, Daily Telegraph, The Guardian.
But that's that is an exception.
But it's what's interesting is almost, it feels from the outside maybe, it kind of feels like journalists are almost quite coordinated in the way that they approach that. Obviously, you get issues as a journalist where you get proprietorial about cases that you write about, which means it's quite difficult to write about one big case. But actually, there's such an amount of media attention around the Letby case. I mean, putting aside, you know, whether she did it or not, I just think that's kind of a fascinating moment to see the media kind of exploring that. And it would be great to see them explore the case of the Birmingham Four, for example. That would be one to see. If the media got behind a case like that, and a lot of the other stories that you've covered in your series, it could really actually make a dramatic difference. But, you know,
I mean, the fallout from Letby may well be interesting. It just depends on what happens. I mean, if a case is referred by the CCRC, goes to the Court of Appeal, Court of Appeal got to decide whether they're going to quash the conviction and order a retrial or just quash the conviction. So there's lots of stages to go. But it is, as John says, it is a case that sort of bucks the trend, where the media, probably because it's worldwide. I mean, I've had people from America asking me what's happening with Lucy Letby. I mean, it has got worldwide significance, and maybe that's the reason. You know, this monster nurse who's supposed to have killed babies for no reason, no motive or whatever that anyone can work out, has captured the interest of, you know, the media, and they've actually done some good stuff.
Yeah.
But generally, as a run-of-the-mill, if you're an ordinary person in a prison somewhere wanting to try and get some publicity for your individual case, you will struggle unless you've got something really dramatic. And it was only at the end, after the conviction of Malkinson was quashed, that the media took an interest in the backstory, in a way.
You might be right, but perhaps towards the end.
Yeah, towards the end, but certainly, you know, they weren't really that bothered for the 17 years.
I think Bob Wolfenden,
but then he...
But Bob Wolfenden wrote about it in his last book, for which he could not get a book done.
I know.
So, the media, we have a system of supposedly open justice, and the idea is the media needs to be present in the courts to as a part of the checks and balances within the justice system. But because we've seen such a retreat and a diminution in the presence of the media in our courts, that's, I think, a real problem for the kind of justice system that we do have. So we want to address that through the Westminster Commission.
Well, if your case is being heard in St Albans Crown Court, you probably stand a much less chance of getting any media attention than if it was in the Old Bailey. I mean, that's the way it works, unfortunately. But, you know, hopefully we can attract more journalists to these cases. But the campaigners, the people you've... They're the ones who absolutely, it's vital for them.
And
the media gives the case.
One of the things the media does is it gives campaigners some support. The impression that I was left with kind of listening to the series, it is, you know, the heroic nature of the campaigners really kind of stuck in this impossible system, but also kind of the loneliness because often they are fighting by themselves. They can't get a lawyer. It's virtually impossible to get a lawyer. You know, they often reach out to the media, but there's very little media interest and they just feel isolated and alone. And yet they keep on fighting. And I think that is really heroic.
There's an interesting statistic that the number of people who get their cases referred, or the people who get their cases referred by the CCRC, are generally those who are represented either by a solicitor or a barrister or someone, you know, who is a campaigner who can put together the arguments. Because the CCRC get these 1,500 applications each year, and sometimes it just says, I'm innocent, can you help me? It doesn't actually go beyond that, because quite a significant number of them just haven't got the ability to actually explain what happened to them in trial. You know, if you think about it, if you're 18 and you've just been convicted of some sort of murder or whatever, the trial process is a mystery to you. You don't understand it. You're not very well educated. You're inarticulate, and I've said to people, you know, what happened at the trial? And they say, I can't remember anything about it. I don't know who gave evidence. I don't know who was on my side or who wasn't. I just found the whole process. I don't know whether it was a week or two or three. I just can't, and none of it remembers. And then that person is then supposed to articulate why the conviction, you know, shouldn't have happened. It's impossible. So, and only about 15% of people who make applications to the CCRC are represented by someone, and they're the ones who get referred. The other, you know, 85%, of which there may well be, you know, really strong miscarriage of justice grounds, but they'd never get a look in. And that's awful because they're, again, back to public, you know, funding, there is virtually no legal aid for helping someone make an application to the CCRC. It's very, very minimal, if it exists at all at the moment. And, you know, it's incredibly low rates. And in a way, the system doesn't want them all to be represented. Do you see what I mean? Because there'd be far more miscarriage of justice going to the Court of Appeal. And the Court of Appeal say, oh, gosh, we can't cope with all these referrals. You know, two or three out of every 100 is about all we can cope with.
And it doesn't look good.
It certainly doesn't look good. They see their job as, it'd be interesting to if you could get an interview with a Lord Justice of Appeal, but basically they see their job as in upholding the integrity of the justice system. not delivering justice. That first priority is keeping the floodgates, closed. They don't want any. That's why they restrict, and why they have criticised the CCRC on occasions quite vociferously for sending them cases that they don't think have got any merit. So the Court of Appeal will listen to a case for, I don't know, 2 days or something. The CCRC might have spent 3 or 4 years working on a case, yet they'll turn it down.
There's a famous quote from Lord Denning at the time of the Birmingham Six, when he said, it's better that we keep 6 innocent people in prison rather than letting them out, because letting them out of prison would be kind of impugning the reputation of the justice system. And it kind of, obviously judges wouldn't say that now, but there is a sense of the defensiveness around, it is hold on to the perception of integrity of the justice system above all else. Yeah. So we haven't travelled
very far. I'm not sure we've travelled any distance, sadly, which we need to if public confidence in the justice system is maintained. But a lot of people don't want to think about the justice system in the way that John and I have been criticising it. They still want it to be as good as they think it was, or they've been told it is. Marnie, as someone who is essentially new to the world of miscarriages of justice, what were your main impressions of the justice system and the people you met on your travels?
I definitely had preconceptions about the justice system. I thought that it was something to be really proud of. It was the best in the world. And it wasn't until I started really getting into these stories and meeting the campaigners that started to change, because I mean, I'd heard of famous miscarriage of justice cases like Andy Malkinson and the post office scandal, but you hear of those stories and you think, oh, how awful. But, those are anomalies. Those are unique. And then what happens when you meet all these campaigners is that you start to notice threads within their stories, similar threads and kind of patterns. And you start to realize that these cases are not unique, and actually it's a really well-trodden path to being wrongfully convicted.
I mean, I agree with everything you've said, and I'm interested in what you say. And someone said to me, if our system was working as well as it should, we wouldn't need the CCRC. And in fact, someone actually said to the first chair, Sir Frederick Crawford, you shouldn't be... this organization shouldn't be necessary, should it? And there was no answer that he could give to that. It's there because the system isn't delivering what it should. 1,500 people applying every year. And we don't even know if everyone who's had a miscarriage of justice applies. Mm. I mean, as I say, the figures on how many miscarriage of justice people are sitting in prisons as we speak now there are no figures. Mm-hmm. No one's ever done the research or tried to work out, but there's a lot of them, and that means that the system isn't working properly. And what we're doing is we're putting an ambulance at the place where there's a horrible black spot of where accidents always happen. We're not actually thinking about trying to avoid those accidents happening in the first place, maybe making the road a bit better or whatever, so you don't need an ambulance stationed there permanently.
Well, thank you both so much for joining me today. It's been such an interesting discussion. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, leave us a review, and we will see you in the next series.